There's some global economy coming up today, some domestic economy as well, a workplace story, and then I want you to think for a minute about how you get to work. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, August the 17th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. So much to talk about, so little time, only 4.5 minutes of live radio, maybe 5 if I play my cards right. I don't know. Let's get going. Catherine Rampell's at the Washington Post. John Harwood is with CNBC. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you, too. So, John, let me start with you, actually. And I want you to go back to Monday with me. The residue from the Turkish lira crisis, the president's response doubling the tariffs. And I want you to discuss for a second, number one, how he's leaning into the political aspects of what are supposed to be these national security tariffs, but also the idea that emerging markets out there are perhaps weaker than anybody knows.
Well, it's a risk that the president has taken, and he seems to have a penchant for, when he is upset, lashing out and inflicting pain. So you have to wonder about the wisdom of the president inflicting pain on a sometime ally in a part of the world that benefits from more stability, not less, and then underscoring the weakness of the emerging markets, as you mentioned. It potentially create some exposure for some financial institutions invested in Turkey. And in the same vein, the president, while he engages in this trade conflict with China, his economic advisor Larry Kudlow was talking yesterday about the Chinese economy hurting and kind of celebrating that. The more you inflict pain on elements of the global economy, the more you run the risk that it affects the United States negatively.
Catherine, John actually made my turn for me. Larry Kudlow, I can't tell you how many times, was on the lawn in front of the White House on cable news this week talking about the weakness of China and how America is going to be strong and going into the election, everything's fine. It's very interesting, given news today, that apparently we've reached some sort of agreement with Mexico on NAFTA or close to it, and also close to it. Let me make sure I make that clear. Close to it. It's not a deal. And also that
2 weeks away. It's always 2 weeks away.
2 weeks away. But also that there's a low-ish level trade delegation going to China to restart those talks.
Look, I think any progress, any instance where both parties are coming back to the table, having decided to shun the table for quite a while, is a good thing. I am trying to keep my expectations in check here, given that in the case of China, for example, these are lower-level officials, as you pointed out. No one on the American side seems to be empowered to actually speak on behalf of the president, which was a major issue when we had higher-level people, including our Treasury Secretary, go over to China, and there were a lot of conflicting objectives.
Within the same delegation. Yeah.
Exactly. Within that same delegation. And that's part of the reason, I think, why we were not able to effectively negotiate, because we don't know what we want. And I think part of the problem is that Trump doesn't know what he wants. You know, he has this fixation with trade deficits, which basically any economist will tell you reflect lots of things much more significant than trade policy, like how much an economy saves and invests, et cetera. And it's not clear exactly what ground he is trying to get China to cede. So even if you have China coming back to the table, if we don't know what we want, if the president doesn't know what he wants, and he doesn't have someone empowered to fight on behalf of that objective, it will be very hard for us to achieve that objective. So again, I'm not super optimistic here.
Yeah, John, go ahead.
The best you can say about this situation is that it definitely does feel better if you stop hitting your head with the hammer. But it's not as if we're preparing some grand new breakthrough that improves the situation that the president found it in when he became president.
So, John, let me stay with you for a second, and I want you to riff on an idea that Kimberly Adams did in a story for us a day or two ago. The idea that if you look at the economic numbers, the Republicans, being the party in power, should be sitting relatively pretty for this election. Setting aside for a moment the idea of the president being on the ballot sort of in an absentia way, talk to me about the reality of that.
Well, the fact is, it's not an economy stupid election. You have the president, who is an intensely polarizing figure, largely along cultural issues. And so you have him both solidifying a base among white blue collar workers and driving away college-educated workers, especially women, white women, who have been supportive of the Republicans in the past. So it's not – this election is not being powered by the economy, although Republicans hope that they can up the emphasis on it and mitigate some of their losses.
Catherine, let me turn super quickly to this tweet from the president this morning talking about how he wants companies to stop reporting quarterly earnings on a quarterly basis and maybe twice a year. Discuss that for a second in terms of what companies actually do and the guidance, and quickly, if you would.
Right. So companies release information about what their existing earnings are. They also release information, or at least the norm is generally, to give some expectations for what investors should expect going forward. And what Trump has suggested is that on the quarterly earnings piece of this, that they shouldn't have to. They shouldn't have to actually release this data. I think this is not obviously a great idea. It's rarely a good thing to give investors less information. Markets operate much more efficiently when there is more information. If you're concerned about so-called short-termism, that managers, CEOs aren't thinking long-term enough, then the way to address that would be to change their incentives, i.e. change the structure
of
their compensation, not to tell investors less information.
Catherine Rempel at The Washington Post, John Harwood at CNBC. Thanks, you two.
Thanks.
Have a nice weekend, everybody. On Wall Street today, you know, it was relatively calm after the week that was. Up a bit. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so President Trump, as Catherine and John and I were talking about, wants companies to have to report earnings just twice a year instead of quarterly. Bearing in mind that a president can't just order the SEC to make new rules, what would this, well, let's call it a proposal then, do exactly? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has the pros and cons.
Being forced to report earnings every single quarter, that can make some managers too focused on short-term performance instead of what's best for the company long-term. Thumbs down. On the plus side, more frequent reporting means more chances for investors to check in on companies. Thumbs up there.
We kind of want the best of both worlds, right?
Amy Hutton at Boston College.
We'd like managers to be held accountable on a fairly frequent basis, but we'd like them to be able to take the long-term view for the best investment and decision-making.
She says the trick to reducing frequency would be to find some other way to preserve accountability, maybe by requiring company boards to monitor quarterly performance, even if that information isn't released publicly. But with any reporting change, beware the unintended consequences, says Marcus Rue, CEO of Guidewire Software, a public company.
One thing I know is that investors really hate surprises, and if you have a longer period of time, you know, 6 months instead of three, for changes to develop, then there's much greater chances for surprise and therefore greater stock market volatility.
Yes, he and his team spend lots of man hours each quarter preparing these reports. Yes, there's lots of pressure to meet market expectations. But Rue's not sure going from every 3 months to every six would make such a big difference. Ray Ball at the University of Chicago agrees. Look at Amazon.
Its profits were negative quarter after quarter after quarter. Investors hung in there because they believed in what Amazon was doing in terms of creating long-term value.
Is Amazon the exception or the rule? That's what the SEC would have to study, weighing the costs and benefits of any change carefully. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
From short-term on Wall Street to a story now about the long game, a really expensive long game, it turns out. Netflix confirmed this week it signed a deal with Kenya Barris, the creator of Black-ish on ABC. Variety says it's a three-year deal, $100 million, a mere pittance relatively to the reported $12 or $13 billion the company's going to spend on content just this year. You throw in all the other streaming services and the cash they are throwing at content, and it's an arms race. From WESA in Pittsburgh, Marketplace's Erica Barris asks where it might end.
These streaming companies are banking on making piles of cash by spending a lot on content now, but keeping subscription prices low.
With the goal of, I think, getting the most customers and then leveraging that going forward.
That's Michael Smith, who teaches information technology at Carnegie Mellon University.
So I think if you look at their business model, they're both trying to expand as rapidly as possible to capture market share.
Expansion means high-profile deals with high-profile creators. Think comedian Dave Chappelle or producer Shonda Rhimes. Will Kreth runs the Entertainment Identifier Registry. He says these deals aren't just about money.
There's a sense of ego, right? If you're able to lure a major studio directors and professionals into your new ecosystem. And if you can put the names of a major international star director in the billing, it gets people's attention. It turns heads.
Because the content racks up award nominations, creates buzz, and reels in subscribers. And maybe eventually, Amazon and Netflix will earn back the billions invested, says Scott Galloway, who teaches marketing at New York University.
They're both looking to be the operating system for the second most important screen in your life, and that's the television. And the prize for whoever wins that race is probably $500 billion in additional market capitalization. So incremental billions seem like chump change.
That space will soon get more crowded. Disney is set to launch its own streaming service next year. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
Just because, you know, it's in the news a little bit this week, we've been talking around here about people recording conversations that happen in the office. It happens a lot, actually, but it's usually the company doing the recording. Think conference calls or other big all-staff meetings. But let's put the microphone in the other hand, shall we? The hand holding a smartphone or a recording pen, I guess, and see what happens then. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has that one.
To record or not to record?
My bosses were divorcing, and things got messy at work.
This is Jessica. We're not using her full name or occupation for fear of professional retribution.
We would often get really contradictory orders.
One time, one of Jessica's bosses told her to go home and not come back.
Oh, yeah, I have that on tape.
She sent the clip to the other boss, who told her to stay, in writing.
Honestly, at first, I was just recording them because I would come home and I would talk to my roommate about these things that were happening at work. And she was like, no, there's no possible way that happened.
A lot of the time when people are recording their boss or colleague at work, it's because there's a major breakdown of trust. Heather Bussing is an attorney, and when recordings come into her office, they're usually of disputed business deals. Still, though,
recording people without letting them know that you're recording them and keeping it to use against them later is kind of a weasel move.
In 12 states, it's an illegal move if you don't get the other person's consent.
There are still laws on the books in every state about when it's legal to record someone and when it's not.
The punishment varies, and the person you recorded can sue you for civil damages in states where it's not legal. But a recording can be useful even in states where a court can't technically accept it as evidence.
There are ways to get it in, even if you can't offer it as direct evidence.
For example, if a recording proves someone is perjuring themselves, it can be used in court. And whether or not you were allowed to make a tape, it can be leveraged outside of court.
In New York State, depending on your job, it is a great idea.
Vince White is an employment attorney with White, Nassar & Hilferty. In New York, you don't need permission from the other person to record. White gets recordings all the time from clients with a whole range of work problems.
The most common is sexual harassment. An intelligent woman says, you know what? Enough. I'll record this idiot. And she does.
Recordings at work can be used as ironclad proof of a whole range of misbehaviors, but he says they can absolutely backfire.
You've made a huge move, a huge aggressive maneuver based on the power of this recording, and it turns out the recording is nothing. Or it turns out you didn't really hear your own tone. You didn't hear maybe you were aggressive, maybe you were leading the person to saying something, and that can be a real issue, especially in front of a jury.
And forget the legal stuff. Recording at work is just plain risky to your continued employment.
They could certainly get fired. They could also get reprimanded. They could get demoted. And then you'll lose trust with your colleagues.
Susan Lamott is CEO of Exaquio, an employer brand and HR consulting firm. She says it's usually not worth the risk.
The case of Omarosa talking about the recordings that she has in the workplace with President Trump, in her case, she has a lot less to lose. She's not concerned about making an hourly wage, and if she loses her job, can she put food on her table?
There are other options. Going through HR is one, and if you're in a state where it's illegal to secretly record, you can take detailed notes right after any encounter. Those are actually really useful in court. You can also just ask people if you can record during a meeting, or bring in someone to witness a meeting.
recordings can go viral so quickly. You can inadvertently do a lot of harm if the allegations are proven not to be true, if you don't capture the whole story, or if the recording gets leaked or shared in a way you hadn't intended.
That tape recording app on your phone, ultimately, is the nuclear option. So maybe treat it that way. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's difficult, but hey, it's life, you know.
Another day, another dollar. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is up 110 today, 110 points, 0.4%, 25,669. The NASDAQ up 9 points, 0.1%, 7816. The S&P 500 also gained 9 points, that is 0.3%, 2850. For the week, the 5 days gone by, the Dow increased 1.4%, the NASDAQ off 0.2%, the S&P 500 improved about 0.5% or so. Amazon slipped 0.2% today. The retail giant is launching the first national TV campaign for its music streaming service Spotify. The current leader in the music streaming space dipped 2%. Apple, owner of iTunes, shined up 1.9% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.86%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hey, everybody, it's Kai, and as you might know, I host a podcast with Molly Wood, Make Me Smart, it's called. This week, we dive into the constant dance of outrage and apology between social media companies and their users, you know, us. Make Me Smart. Check it out. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. It was a year ago today that Harvey turned into a tropical storm out in the Atlantic Ocean. And then over the next 3 weeks through the Caribbean, across the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, and then into South Texas, more than 30 people were killed. Thousands of families were displaced, and $125 billion in damage was done. Rockport, Texas is where the hurricane made landfall in the continental United States. And a year later, things are better, but they're not back. Marketplace's Andy Euler is in Rockport. Hey.
Hey, Kai.
So give me the compare and contrast, would you? You were there after the storm hit a year ago. What's it like today?
You know, there has been a ton of progress. I've been driving around the city just trying to figure out how things are going. And you see a lot of construction happening. You see a lot of people just sort of milling about in town, spending money, you know, going out to the beach. It didn't happen last year. It wasn't happening, certainly when I was here. So there are a lot of positives, but at the same time, when you walk around and you drive around here, you're still seeing lots of businesses still boarded up. There are a lot along the seafront specifically that just haven't opened, and you don't really know if they're actually going to open. I'll give you some numbers. Yeah. 84% of businesses that were here before the storm are back. But only half of the hotel rooms, about 900 rooms right now, are available for folks to stay in. So if you're visiting and you're trying to spend money here in Rockport, you're going to have a tough time figuring out where to stay.
And we should be clear here. This is a beach town, right?
Right. You know, it's a tourist town.
For the locals, though, they need insurance money to rebuild. How's that coming?
It depends on who you're talking to. I talked to a restaurant owner, Craig Griffin. He owns a bunch of properties here. He owns a restaurant called Charlotte Plumbers. He said he had to make the decision to rebuild the property before he got his insurance check because he wanted to sort of revitalize the economy. He wanted to be a part of that rebuilding process, but he spent his own money to do it. And so now he's just sitting and waiting. He's talking about going into mediation with the insurance company. It's tough for him.
Getting the insurance money is the biggest hurdle of all. I owe a contractor $1.5 million. That's tough to go to sleep every night knowing you owe somebody that much money and you're still fighting to get it.
God, he owes $1.5 million.
Right.
Other than the money, what else are folks there dealing with, even though money's a big one?
Right. I mean, people like Craig, who has a staff, he says the hardest thing for him is to hold on to people and also find them places to stay because the apartment complexes, so many of the condo buildings, they're not here anymore and they're not being rebuilt because those insurance checks that he's waiting on haven't been cut. So he doesn't know where he's going to be able to put his employees when they come back to work here. So it's just a shortage of places to stay. It was the same thing last year. Now it's just been exacerbated because there are so many more opportunities, so many more businesses, but they don't have any place to stay.
Right. Andy Euler in Rockport, Texas, for us. Stories coming up next week here and on the morning show as well. Andy, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kat.
Think for a second about how you got to work today. Maybe you had a short or not short walk. Maybe you rode a bike. But if you're like most of us, 85% of us, according to the Census Bureau, 85% of the people in this economy who commute to work do so by car. But there's a whole slice of the labor force that doesn't have that option, that's forced to rely on public transportation. And in Dallas, to pick just one city, half of the people who get to and from their jobs by mass transit spend 45 minutes each way doing it. And time being money, that commute gets expensive in a hurry. From KERA in Dallas, Courtney Collins reports.
Chris Crowley can't afford a car, so every afternoon his commute starts with a walk from his house to a light rail station about a mile away. This summer, temperatures have reached 110 degrees.
I just keep on trucking along.
Crowley boards one train, then another, then catches a bus, then a second bus, to reach his job at a Home Depot distribution center 15 miles away. All told, it takes him 3 hours to get there, and that's just one way.
My job starts at 4:30. I actually have to leave the house at like 12:45.
That overnight shift ends at 3 in the morning. During the work week, Crowley says he maxes out at 4 hours of sleep a night, 2 hours less than his daily commute.
You save up all your sleep for your days off?
I save it all for my days off.
Still, the 39-year-old sees the upside of all that walking and what it does for his health.
I got a lot more energy, lighter on my feet, a little more stamina, so, you know, I can't complain on it.
He likes his job and the pay is good, $14 an hour plus health and retirement benefits, compared to the $9 an hour plus health he was getting before at Target. Moving closer to work isn't really an option because he shares a house with his parents in the neighborhood he's always called home.
This is my roots. I was born and raised over in this neighborhood. And I always said I want to die in this neighborhood.
Crowley's making more money now than he was this time last year. But after kicking in for rent, buying food, paying his $55 phone bill and $359 in child support, he's only able to put aside about $50 a month. He'd like to save enough to buy a car outright. No monthly payment.
But I just never wanted to go there. I always wanted to buy me a car, not have to worry about spending extra money for the car note. That way that money can go in my pocket for something else, you know.
The commute costs Crowley just about $80 a month. What it really costs him is time. Frances DeVinny is with the Austin-based Center for Public Policy Priorities.
That's time taken away from their families. It's time where they can't actually look for or have another job. It's time where they couldn't be getting an additional education or certificate to be able to advance themselves.
DeVinny says many well-paid jobs are clustered far from convenient public transit routes, forcing people without cars to spend a lot of time mapping out a way to work.
They may have to travel a really long way to get the job that actually pays a little bit of a better wage.
Chris Crowley says he'll put up with the long commute because he sees potential in this job.
Right now, like I say, I'm moving merchandise around and unloading trucks. But, you know, you can move up easily to a manager or assistant manager position.
He can see this company being the one he sticks with for the rest of his working days.
I want to buy me some land. I really want to buy me some land, put me a house on it, and this is mine.
As much as he believes in that dream, reality is expensive.
You know, I'm making pretty good money and, yeah, okay thing, but, you know, stuff still costs and it's only getting higher, you know. It's difficult, but, hey, it's life, you know. We either deal with it or you don't.
And that's what he holds on to as he jams a hat on his head, grabs a jug of iced sweet tea, and takes the first few steps of that 3-hour commute. In Dallas, I'm Courtney Collins for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, sad, yes, but an object lesson in how much debt is too much. In a week where we learned American consumer debt now stands at a record $13.3 trillion, this item, the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library Foundation, which supports Lincoln's Library and Museum in Springfield, Illinois, is almost $10 million in the hole. And this week said it's considering auctioning off some of its memorabilia to pay what it owes. It's got a year, plus or minus, to raise $9.7 million, even started a GoFundMe page. But that page has a long way to go. $18,190 has been donated so far. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 110 points today, 0.4%. NASDAQ up 9 points, 0.1%. S&P 500 also up 9. That is 0.3% mixed for the week, by the way. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.